When Wyatt Tumor was 5 years old, she was watching a tape of The Sound of Music on her parents' VCR when her father suggested a game they'd never played before. As an unfamiliar popping noise kept sounding from outside, first he told her and her sisters, 1-4, 1-6, and their grandmother to lie on the ground. Then he strapped on a backpack and told them how to play. "When I say go, we run to the woods, okay?" Moore's father told his tiny girls not to be afraid, that those booming sounds were distant drums. In fact, they were rifles. The first Liberian Civil War had begun, and they were leaving home with nothing but the clothes on their backs to literally run for their lives. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. The life and death drama of Wyatt Moore's story might have ended when her family was finally escorted out of hiding by a teenage girl, a rebel soldier hired by their mother, who had been in the U.S. on a Fulbright scholarship when the fighting broke out. But there was plenty more struggle to come, even in her adopted home in the United States. Moore had escaped the perils of armed conflict, thanks to her father's strength and courage, but he couldn't protect her from the hardships of being a Black African girl in a society that seemed to prefer white people. Writer Wyatt Moore's memoir is called The Dragons, the Giant, the Women. Wyatt, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me. Thanks for that introduction.
Well, I really enjoyed is sort of the wrong word. It's a very hard book to read in a lot of ways, but it's a brilliantly told story. So you had just barely turned five when this war broke out, so none of the politics meant anything to you at the time. But when you heard the adults in your life talking about these things, you conflated it all with this kind of mythological monster that you'd heard about in stories. How did you imagine this dragon battling for control of your country?
Right. So my dad had, and my grandmother, I would say all of the authority figures in my life at the time were very committed to making sure that we had a full and textured childhood, and that included storytelling. So we heard stories all the time, and I think it was just the perfect moment for them to put those stories and our imaginations into action by ensuring that we were able to maintain our childhood through our understanding of what was going on around us. So that meant that they had to work overtime to preserve our childhood. And they did that through relating what was happening at the time during the war to various things that various stories and myths that we had only recently heard in previous months and during the previous year of my memory. So it was, I would say, an easy transition. Storytelling was always a part of my life. My father didn't just introduce some of these images to us when the war began. He just used what he had already started and the legacy of storytelling in Liberia and within the Vai culture to make sure that we had an opportunity to make the most of what was going on, if that's even possible during a war. But so when we were walking, for instance, and there were dead bodies, he would say, "Oh, you know, why are these people sleeping? Remember the story about, you know, Oma Fene and how she kept on sleeping and she couldn't wake up? And, oh, these people are sleeping just like her." And I respect and honor my father so much for doing that for us.
Yeah, it's really interesting to read this story as an adult. You tell the early part of it through your eyes as a five-year-old, but, you know, adult readers will recognize what it must have been like for your father. And the thought of you and your sisters were so tiny. Your youngest sister was small enough that she had to be carried. You were only five. And the question I had, I wondered if you wanted to be carried too, but of course you had to run because you only had one set of arms.
Yeah, so there were actually moments during our experience where I was on his shoulders. So he carried my sister and he held me on his shoulders because he definitely, and as I said, my dad has always been a phenomenal being to me because the things that he was balancing and continued to balance even after our immigration were always impressive to me. So he, I think, perhaps sensed that I also wanted to or needed that sort of assurance by physical touch and the affection that he was clearly giving to my younger sister. So there were definitely moments during the war where he just put me on his shoulder. So I was carried too.
And he is the giant in your title.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And still now he's a giant in my life now.
When this all started for you, you didn't even know what a gun was. You described seeing, you call it a long pipe that was the color of dirt that these soldiers mm-hmm. were carrying. Do you mm-hmm. remember the moment where you realized, oh, that's a gun?
So it was much, much later. So I think I was always a fairly cynical kid and always precocious. So even when they were telling us that, oh, you know, those are drum beats, when we were hearing gunshots, I did sense that there was something, there was an underbelly that was not being presented to us. And I do remember asking my sister, and of course my sister didn't know, she would just be like, you know, just listen to dad. But anytime I would ask a caregiver, my grandmother, she continued to insist. It wasn't until we were hiding out in the village and we obviously suffered a loss of a family member that all of those images began to replay. And I realized that there was indeed something a lot more sinister going on. And I would say that that was the moment that was definitely a stark transition for me within that experience of willfully being ignorant to what was happening around us, to really indulging my childhood curiosity and trusting that there was something a lot more traumatic that was happening around us.
Could you tell that the adults were afraid?
You know, at moments, I will say that my dad was very genius in his ability to hide it. He definitely was. And it wasn't necessarily that he was smiling a lot, because I do think that if he were smiling a lot, I would have been a lot more suspicious. He just maintained who he naturally was. But it seemed as if we were in this prolonged bedtime story, right? Because when it was only during bedtime, right before we slept, that he would you know, be transformed into something that was more colorful and more textured and someone who was a lot more big and animated. And I would say that he relied on that much more during the experience than he normally would have. And so because it maintained, and obviously at points, certainly when we went through checkpoints, and one of which, as I detailed in the book, that my dad was held, and we were definitely afraid, and he looked afraid during that point. But otherwise, I can't say that I did. They worked overtime, as I stated before, to preserve our childhood and to make sure that there was some of us that was left, because obviously they recognized that there were many things that they were saying that we wouldn't buy, even if they were committed to the ruse. There were a lot of things that even now, when I have conversations with my dad or my grandmother, they always just say, oh, we were just doing the best we could. We did the best we could.
Before the sort of trauma of flight, you and your sisters, more than anything, missed your mother, who was away studying. You knew that you would be reunited, but of course you were little kids and you missed her. And I'm struck, too, by the fact that it sounds, you recount here, you and your sisters asking many, many times, are we going to go see our mother? And, you know, he would say soon, or we don't know when, but we'll get together. And if he ever lost his temper with you during this time of extraordinary stress and fear for him, you don't recount it in these pages. It's really amazing to me.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's amazing to me in my memory that I don't recall any time that he lost his temper too. You know, I always say my parents, their love for each other was phenomenal. Their love for each other is what in many ways helped us to survive the war. And I think it's his love and commitment to my mother that ensured that we were not only physically safe, but psychologically safe. So there were things that he was emotionally muting within himself and within his natural responses to ensure that we were mentally safe during that time. And obviously, he knew that any flare-up or any loss of temper, any aggravation of his senses and sensibility would destroy what he had been trying to preserve during the entire time out of Monrovia and to the village, and even while we were in the village. And so we knew, they had always told us when we were at home, oh, we're going to go on a trip one day to see your mom. So the reason that we continue to ask is because we just assumed that, oh, we finally left the house. We're on a trip. Obviously, it's not as idyllic as we imagined it would be, but we're going to go see mom now, right? And so oddly enough, I actually remember him saying soon being an assurance, right? I didn't second guess it. I was assured by it. But when we did lose that family member while we were in hiding, that is when all of that was that facade was shattered.
Is there a big sort of difference between your brother who was born in the US and you and your sisters who have memories of surviving the war?
So I have two brothers who were born here, one who was born in New York, of course, while the war was going on, and then one who was born in Memphis. And the book is actually dedicated to them. In the beginning of the book, I say, "Whatever you are, I am," because I do think I had a very candid conversation with one of my brothers, maybe about a decade ago. And he was expressing that in many ways, like when we talked about different things that were going on in Liberia, or we talked about immigration and the immigration system here in the United States. He would say that a part of him felt like he always felt as though he were a part of our family. We're very close-knit family, but those were the only times that he felt as if he were missing something, and an outsider. And he felt that my other brother might have had the same sentiment. And so we had just a really inspiring conversation about how, even though our family has different histories, up to a certain point, we are very much the same. They say that they cannot reference Liberia in the same ways that we can. Even now, obviously years and years later after, they've visited many times. One of my brothers actually lived there earlier this year and only just got back to Texas. It still doesn't feel, it lacks the intimacy that we experience in our recollection of it, in our experience there. And so it has been, it is something that I realized was a topic for discussion as a culturally mixed family, and a family with like mixed or a variety of statuses in the US. But I think at the core, we realize and we're very transparent and communicative about the fact that we love each other very much, and no matter what, we're the same at our core.
So, as an adolescent and as an adult, you've struggled now and then with depression and anxiety, and you write about your therapist trying to ascribe all of that to those traumatic months in your childhood, and you really pushed back on that. Can you talk about your sense of things that did and did not harm you emotionally as you were growing up?
Right. So I would say that the sadness that I experienced in my adulthood, less so my adolescence. My adolescence, I had nightmares that were really triggered by our experiences before immigrating here. But in my adulthood, the sadness that I felt was it stemmed from a breakup that I had, actually coincidentally, after everything that my family had gone through. It was really just it was a breakup that, made me the saddest that I'd felt for a few months or so. And I remember seeking therapy, and it was during the therapy sessions that she was digging into what had happened, before, while I was 5 years old, so early on. And I would say that my resistance to just seeking help in that way was because there was a little bit of guilt that is definitely true of my experience in the United States, because for the most part, if anyone asked me about my childhood in Texas, I would say I had a fairly happy upbringing, very middle class upbringing. I mean, my parents, they worked hard within the first few years after our immigration to ensure that we had a good life. They were working hard to make sure that they had comparable jobs to what they had in Liberia, but they worked overtime to assure that we were comfortable. And so, in speaking of or in talking about trauma, I think that there was definitely some guilt there. And I felt as if I recognized that there is the sadness I feel now is somehow linked to what I experienced when I was younger, then that is somehow being ungrateful for this actually very happy childhood and adolescence that I had post-immigration. You understand? So all of those emotions were being balanced, and I think that definitely contributed to my resistance.
You write that the stress of first generation Black Americans, Black immigrants, is the stress of what you call never arriving. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of identity, and America's very complex, right? Because I think all immigrants view America as a kind of emerald city of the world when you aren't here. And then you come to America, and in many ways, it's realized as that. You do have opportunities that many people wouldn't have back home, and you are able to make it and succeed. And I don't take for granted the fact that my family has done well in America. But even still, there is an institutional dynamic that is at the core of the country that affects the experience of immigrants, depending on which group they're a part of, or the color of their skin, right? So, as a Black immigrant, I might have a different experience in America than someone who immigrated from a Western country, right? And that's not always explicit. It isn't, something that's explicitly experienced. A lot of what happens exists in the nuance. And so, what happens is when many Black immigrants come here, you do feel a little discouraged, and it's almost as if this like a fairy tale that you dreamed of for so long, and you get introduced to the fairy tale, and you begin to live the fairy tale, and then in your fifth day within this fairy tale, something happens to shatter it. And that's the experience of just this very stunning, abrupt moment of disillusionment when you realize that sometimes racism does disrupt and as well as corrupt your experience here and your experience as someone who came to this country for opportunity and for its dynamism.
You write that America let you know very quickly that Black people were seen as less than. I wonder if your parents had done anything like before that first day of school to prepare you for that possibility that you'd be treated that way.
Not at all. I actually was having this conversation recently about how my parents, my family at home, we didn't talk about race as much as I realized my peers and their families were talking about race. My parents they said, do your best, just work very hard. You know why we came here, you know what we sacrificed to be here, work very hard and you'll be able to succeed or you'll get far. And it was in later years where things would happen, and then I would bring it up, and oh, my friend so and so, friend X or friend Y says, maybe it has a racial component, or maybe this is happening because of, because we're Black, not because someone was having a bad day, or whatever excuse that we had labeled. And that's when those conversations really opened up, but it was way, way beyond the point that we had immigrated here, right? It was way after. And so no, there was no preparation, because I think my parents still, particularly at the beginning, had the hopefulness that most immigrants have, that okay, we're here, we're safe, let's see what we can do with this second chance, let's see what we can do with this opportunity.
So your parents seem to have made, if there was a dividing line in their minds, a kind of us and them, it was like Christians and other people. All Christians were their
Yes.
people, regardless of skin color. And I wonder, I mean, surely they experienced racism that they were aware of. Do you feel like it was almost like a willful denial and like a way of getting through that racism, like almost pretending that as long as someone was Christian, they must be on their side?
I think that, or not even think, I think in the conversations that I've had with my parents in my adulthood about everything that we experienced in this country before they left again, I would say that they revealed that there was a lot of there was they were dealing with a massive heartbreak when the war came out in Liberia. We were young enough to where we were not as emotionally attached to the country, but that this was their home. And so their hearts were broken. And I do assume that in their denial, perhaps willful denial of some of the things that they were experiencing, although they always deemed it to the individual, right? Not the system. They would always say, this person was a that person's a jerk, or what happened to that person this morning? Or, some people are so wicked, like not saying assigning that to any racial category or religious category. It was always the individual. And so some days I think it was willful denial, and some days I think that they just have the perspective of the world, which is, to me, at times enlightened and beautiful, where they do consider individuals, while still obviously giving credit to some of the nuances and giving credit to some of the institutional dynamics that contribute to individual responses. they are and have always been just very hopeful when it comes to the human race and always able to see the best in people, no matter where they were.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. I will say your parents were, perhaps still are, appalled by Halloween, right? So you and your sisters come home the first time you've gone to school and found your classmates all in costume. You didn't know what this magic was. You like the idea of going door to door to get candy. How did they sort of try and raise you in ways that kept you from falling into what they did perceive to be some of the bad habits of native born Americans?
Oh, I love that question. So I was raised in Texas, very fundamentalist Christian area north of Houston. And what happened is that local churches, mine included, and my parents played a huge role in my local church, they would have these Halloween alternatives. And so we would go to church and we would dress up as Bible characters. And my sisters and I always dressed up as, like, it was either like the three wise men, or it would be like a mashup of Mary and Ruth and Sarah. and our best iterations of them. And then we would go, you'd have to go around to different rooms within the church and you'd say memory verses for candy or a Bible fact for candy. And so we would come home and just compare the different candy that we had. But even when we came home, because we weren't getting a lot of candy, where we were getting anywhere as much as our classmates, but our beds were always covered with candy because my mom would go to the store and buy a ton of candy. And so anytime we came home from our alternative Halloweens, we always had something to take to school the next day. So I think that they were always trying to make sure that we were easing into this new life and this new world. And, you know, they were always sensitive to the individual traumas that we might have been experiencing, or post-traumatic stresses that we might have been experiencing as young children. And so they were doing their best to ensure, as I stated before, that we were comfortable and as happy as possible.
I don't think anyone's ever regretted having parents that they describe as having a great and extraordinary love story. I mean, what a blessing for any child to grow up with that. But you do say it made it a little hard for your parents to relate to the sort of trials and travails of your dating life.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I mean, I that's one of the things I perhaps talked to the therapist about for the short time that I was seeing her, was that I was for a long time comparing my prospects and the things that I was experiencing to my mom's relationship, my parents' relationship, and the things that they went through. And that in expecting that magnitude, I mean, traveling across the Atlantic to save your family, you're paying a rebel to traffic your family out of from one country to another, that sort of grandiosity doesn't really exist regularly. It exists, certainly it did exist, and they're an example of that, but most relationships don't go through that. And that's something that I realized only later on, that I was expecting these very grand gestures, and as dynamic a love story as I understood my parents to be and my grandparents to be. And I had to really train myself with everything that was going on in my understanding of my identity to just exist, right? Like, I am who I am this moment, right now. Right now I'm having a conversation with on Think, and that's beautiful. And, you know, considering all of these things that might have happened in the past, or all these things that perhaps will happen in the future, if any way it takes away from and it corrupts the beauty of this moment. And the same thing was happening in my journeys with love. I was thinking of the past and everything that contributed to my understanding of love, which existed in the past, and everything I dreamed of in the future, which was based in the past and the understanding from my family, as opposed to just living for the now and living in the moment. And I think that greatly assisted me in dealing with some of the traumas that I experienced as a child, too, learning to exist in the present.
As an adult, you got really invested in learning more about this mysterious young woman that your mother paid to help get you and your father and your sisters out of the country and across the border. Why do you think you wanted to know more about her?
You know, I think it was a mixture of many things. Particularly, it was around the time that the Black Lives Matter movement had, like, just started or newly started. And I realized that there's really no understanding of racism in this country without an interrogation of Black femininity, Black womanhood, because Black womanhood is at the intersection of so many different disenfranchisements within this country. And obviously then what that led to was then an exploration of these people in my life who were women, were Black women who had contributed to who I considered myself to be in that moment. And she was one of them, but she was one who I knew the least about. I know everything about my mother. I know my aunts intimately. I know the, people who I met in church and the teachers who had contributed to my life in a very significant way. But when it came to this woman, she is probably one of the greatest influences and in many ways directly the reason that I'm able to have this conversation with you now. But I knew so little about her, and that piqued my curiosity in a very dramatic way.
So, what were you able to find out about her, Wayetu, that you hadn't known before you started?
So I was not able to locate her, unfortunately, but I did have an opportunity to talk to other women who were trafficking people's families out of the country as well. And I learned that there was a system that was created. There was an entire enterprise that was fairly vast. Many of the women who were, because when you talk about or when you hear about child soldiers during many of these conflicts, it heavily leans on the male experience. And you don't hear about the little girls who are recruited, who have to fight, or who are sexually abused in many ways by these rebel factions. And so having an opportunity to talk to some of these women and learn that the ways that they were reconciling their traumas and making peace with some of the brutalities that they enacted was by creating this system where they were helping people's families, usually by lying and saying, "Oh no, this is someone from my neighborhood. They're not with the ethnic group you think that they're from," or, they would take people's families across borders like mine and lie to soldiers and say that they were transporting prisoners. And so I had no idea that it was as intelligent and as calculated as it was before I started my search for Sata.
To the point that you made earlier about your parents striving to sort of see every individual as an individual rather than a member of a group, it sounds like one of the things you discovered was that a lot of these women, I mean, they had done very bad things, objectively bad. They also tried to do very good things. It was kind of impossible to put a label on people.
Yeah, exactly. I was having a conversation earlier today where we explored the reality that many times narratives, particularly narratives in these countries that suffer dramatic social, political, infrastructural issues, their histories are told in the binary. It's like good versus bad, righteous versus evil. The settler class versus the native class in Liberia's instance, or excuse me. So I think that most of history, though, exists somewhere in the middle. It is not as binary as what we've been presented. And so that is something that I carry with me. Most people exist somewhere in the middle. Most histories exist somewhere in the middle, and even identity. Even if it's someone who was born and raised in the same place their entire life and isn't someone with as varied an experience as I had, their understanding of themselves is probably in the middle ground or exists in some gray area. And I have peace in that.
One thing that always upset your mother, I think others in your family as well, was the really one-dimensional view a lot of Americans of all races seem to have of people who come from the continent of Africa and maybe Liberia specifically. Has that gotten any better?
I don't think so, but I am hopeful because I do find that through the arts, through storytelling, whether it's through these memoirs that are being packaged and consumed in the West, or now the growth of the media industry and creative technologies, that you have movies that are coming out of Liberia and, of course, our neighbors, Ghana and Nigeria, with Nollywood, that are really opening people's eyes to how dynamic and complex the infrastructure, the social infrastructure of some of these countries are. So I have hope.
How do you define your identity today?
Right now, I am a woman who is having a conversation on Think with another woman, and I am currently leaning into and really spiritually enjoying recollections of my past in Liberia, recollections of my past in Texas, and also looking forward to seeing my daughter a little later on. So also basking in motherhood. That is who I am in this moment.
Well, we will let you get back to that sweet baby. Writer Wayetu Moore's memoir is The Dragons, The Giant, The Women. Wayetu, it's been a real pleasure. Thanks for taking the time to tell us your story.
Thank you so much for this really wonderful interview.
You can like our page on Facebook. We're on Twitter at KERA Think. If you want the podcast, it's available free wherever you get your podcast. Just search for KERA Think and then subscribe. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.